The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. If you're lucky, you'll get old. If you're luckier, you'll be old for quite a while. And you probably won't be alone. An aging population and advances in modern medicine mean that more of us than ever are reaching our post-80 years. Statistics Canada says the number of Canadians in that bracket will more than double to 3.3 million by 2036. And that same shift is happening in almost every developed country. People are living longer and learning more about what happens to lives as they inch towards the century mark. And those people who have to grapple with loss and illness and loneliness and limitations have a lot to teach the rest of us, which is why John Leland set out to learn those lessons. So what do the very elderly know about life that we don't? A lot, obviously, but less obvious is the fact that the secrets they've found work for us right now at any age. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
God, do you think old age is going to be horrible? Could never happen to you. And then it happens, and you deal with it.
John Leland is a New York Times reporter and the author of Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John, first of all, tell me about this project.
So in 2015, I set out to write a year-long series where I would follow six people over age 85 just to find out what their lives were like. Because so much of what we think about old age comes from people who have never been old. As I went on, what I started to find out was how much we can learn, whatever age we are, from people who have lived long enough to know something about life. They're actually the experts in living. They've dealt with loss. They've seen setbacks in their lives and triumphs in their lives. How do you deal with those when you've had some experience with them?
Looking back now, what is the most wrong assumption you had when you proposed a series and ultimately a book following people over the age of 85?
When I started this, I thought I was just going to write about the hardships of getting old. I thought all there was to tell about old age was the toll that it took on people's minds and on their bodies, because that's how we write about old age. And I figured the series I was going to do would be basically the malady of the month. One month somebody would fall and their life would go to heck, and the next month somebody would start to forget things and their life would go downhill. And what I found was that they did have a lot of the maladies that I expected, but they all dealt with them, and none of them defined themselves by their disabilities or their losses. Only other people define them that way.
Yeah, because when you think about a series like this, as somebody who is thankfully quite a bit away from old age, you feel like it would be depressing, but that's not what I got from your pieces.
No, and it's not because I was Pollyannish about it or that the people were Pollyannish about it. There were real problems that I wrote about. People had health issues, and one of the people said every time we got together that he wanted to die. But they'd been dealing with loss for a long time, and they knew how to deal with loss. So they taught these lessons we all know. We all know we should be grateful. It gets hard to be grateful when life hits the fan, right?
What is life for the extremely old like in the mid-2010s? Because I feel like it's a lot different than we would have imagined it even 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, the first thing I would say, it's as different for people throughout that age group as it is. Life is different for people at age 40 or different at age 20. It depends on where you are. Everybody's different. That group is as diverse and their experiences are as diverse as any other age group that you can think of. But what I would say is people, the older generation now, is better educated than any other cohort of people that age. There's more of them. When I was born, there were fewer than a million people over age 85 in the USA. And now there's about 6 million. So it's like that population is multiplied six times. And they're coming to these late years not broken down by physical labor in the way that people had been in the past.
Right.
And they have more resources, better education, and there's treatments for acute diseases that there didn't used to be. And so what people are facing is sort of chronic health problems, things that get exacerbated over time, like arthritis or diabetes.
One of the maxims that I saw come out of your pieces and also your book is that if you want to be happy, learn to think like an old person. What does that mean?
It means getting rid of some of the distractions. The people that I've spent this time with are kind of literally dealing with matters of life and death. So their focus is on what's important and not on what's trivial. They're focusing on what is in life, not on what isn't. You know, imagine if you discovered tomorrow morning when you woke up that you had 3 days to live. How would you live them? Who would you spend them with? What would be important to you? And what would you just leave by the wayside because there just wasn't time for that anymore? But we don't do it. But these people actually were looking at the finiteness of their days. And so they were finding ways to do that. Not all the time, because they're not perfect people. They're not saints. They're just human beings. But they had this constant reminder that life is finite.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is it a tangible thing to them? Like, I know on the one hand, you're well aware that you're closer to the end of your life than you might like to be. But do they actually think about that in the terms that you kind of just laid out? Like, tomorrow could be my last day, so I might as well do this. Or is that kind of more a metaphor for the way they're living?
I don't think it's consciously in the forefront of their minds, but it's an awareness that they have. And they just live their lives a little bit different. The people I dealt with, again, are over age 85. And now the youngest of them is 93, because I've still been following them. But, you know, they've lost their spouses, often in very intimate ways. They've lost their parents. They've lost their friends, then their peers. So that death isn't this kind of abstract thing for them. You know, I'm just about 60. The loss of my father is still fresh for me, but not all my peers, not my spouse. I haven't been through that. So it's still hard for me to remember that I'm not going to be around forever, and that person I met on the street today, I maybe never see them again. And so I'm not getting the most out of that encounter with them if I go into it with that attitude. But if I do think that, if I think this time I'm listening to this favorite piece of music of mine, or this conversation I have with you now might be the last time we ever talk, I'm going to focus on it much more and get much more out of it. And I'll be rewarded for that.
Out of all the stories you heard from them and experiences you had with them, what's one that has stuck with you after this reporting was over?
You know, one of the things was, one of the people in the book is Jonas Mekas, who's a pioneer of avant-garde filmmaking since the 1950s. And he's the only semi-famous person in the book. And I remember in March of 2015 going to a jazz club in Greenwich Village, and Jonas is on stage, and he says, he's reading from a novella that he's written, and he says, "Have you ever thought about how amazing, really amazing, life is?" And I'm in the back of the club with a table full of Lithuanian opera singers, and I'm 55 years old, and I'm going through a divorce, and I'm thinking, yeah, I've probably thought that once or twice. But at that point, I've been following Jonas for about 3 months, and I realize Jonas thinks that way, thinks about how amazing life is all the time. So that became the challenge for me. How do you think about this, not once or twice over a 50-year period, but how to live thinking about that all the time, how amazing, really amazing life is?
Are there small things that Jonas or any of the other folks you profiled do to sort of keep that front and center in their minds?
It's all small things, because you don't do big things anymore. You know, it's remembering to do these things throughout the day
like
and night.
What?
There was a man, Fred Jones, and Fred was 87 when I met him, and he's living alone in a walk-up apartment in Brooklyn, and he's losing two toes to gangrene. You know, classic social isolation, right?
Yeah.
And I asked Fred his favorite part of the day, and Fred said, waking up in the morning and saying, "Thank God for another day, on my way to 110. And it's just that little thing, just starting the day like that meant Fred was almost always in a good mood when I went to see him, and I was always in a good mood after I saw him. And it wasn't because Fred's life was easy, but he just always found these things to be grateful for, even when it was very hard. And because he did that, he just didn't have time to complain about some of the things that were missing in his life. You know, that cliche of the glass half full, half empty. You know, Fred was only looking at the water at the bottom of the glass, and he wasn't thinking about that empty space at the top, all the things that were missing from his life.
Up next.
We don't listen to them. No one asks old people what old age is like. What kind of social engagement do you want? What sort of interaction do you want? What do you want from us? What do you want from each other? What do you want to give us? Because people want to be useful. They want to give things.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us. How easy or hard did you find it not to sort of think about these things? Because I think the inspirational thoughts that we can take from this are kind of self-evident, but to actually make those changes in your life, to actually have those conscious, grateful thoughts.
I mean, this is what I say all the time. Doing the lessons they give me are all easy. Remembering to do them is hard. And it's just a conscious thing. It's the thing that I have found the most beneficial is just starting off the day. When the day is fresh and nobody's pulling at me to do this, that, or the other, I try to keep these things in mind and practice them first thing in the day before anything's pulled out. So if I can wake up and just say, gosh, it's another day, I'm up. And then you remember, gosh, I'm with this person I love. I'm just going to give her a kiss to start the day. And that just changes the way the day goes. Oh, I'm going to walk my dog. I'm going to say hi to this person I pass, the strangers that I pass, instead of just walking by them. It's really, really little things, but we forget to do them when the day hits the fan. And if we remember to do them, sort of get that automatic muscle memory going early in the day, it just kind of helps you get through the day. And then that one that helps me later in the day when things get really, really hard, again, comes from Jonas Mekas. We were talking one day and I was worried about like stuff that was going on in the world, stuff that might happen. And Jonas goes, I never worry. I'll start to worry when something happens. Why worry when it's not happening? And then why worry when it happens? You deal with it. You waste time worrying and it may never happen what you think. That was a clear lesson of old age. God, you think old age is going to be horrible. Could never happen to you. And then it happens, and you deal with it.
It's funny because one of the other questions I was going to ask you was about those distractions. And when you say, you know, don't worry about things that haven't happened yet. For whatever reason, the first thing that came to my mind is my Twitter feed.
Yes.
And I just wonder how hard is it for people who aren't staring at the end of their lives to really block out those distractions, because it's hard not to worry about climate change when, yes, it hasn't happened yet, but also I'm, or at least my children, are probably going to be around for the worst of it. And that's a hard distraction to block out.
Well, what I'm not saying is arguing for complacency. I'm not saying we should stick our heads in the sand. What we should do is address these things. And I think what I found was that I had greater energy to address things like climate change and make steps that I could make in that direction when I wasn't worried that the sky might someday fall and that I might someday get old and all these hardships might someday fall my way. Let's take a look at this. Climate change is real. It's not some future thing. It's going on now. Maybe it's not threatening us immediately right now, but it's something that's real. How do we address that? How do we focus on what is and not on what isn't? And I think that a lot of the tactics of people who are activists in the climate change movement, God love them, their hearts are pure, but they have this interest in presenting worst-case scenarios to us all the time.
Right.
And I think people, it can be effective, it can really get into your head, but it doesn't mobilize people in quite the same way as if you said, look, Jordan, tomorrow you can go out and do this. Right this second, you can do this. You know, that gives you something to do, and you can do it. And the feeling of doing that makes you do the next thing tomorrow.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is what we can do as, I mean, Canadian and American society are reasonably tied together, to prepare for the fact that we already do, and are going to have even more people over age 85. From following these folks, what did you learn about what they need from us and how we can prepare for a world in which more people are living longer than ever?
Well, what they need from us, I think, is the easy part of that to answer. We don't listen to them. No one asks old people what old age is like. We ask gerontologists what old age is like. We ask, our depictions of old age in movies, as rare as it is, or in books. Those all come from younger people, right? But we don't ask older people, what is it you want? You know, what kind of social engagement do you want? What sort of interaction do you want? What do you want from us? What do you want from each other? What do you want to give us? Because people want to be useful. They want to give things. So that's the part for them. How do we prepare for it? I think by thinking of old age, for the first part, not as a problem that needs to be fixed, because we're not going to fix it, but as this incredible resource to tap. What do people know about living who have lived long enough? We just passed through the Great Recession. You know, when I started this project in 2015, it really felt fresh. The people I was interviewing had been through the Depression. They knew about breadlines. They had a perspective on this that was really, really valuable for me. Jonas Mekas had been through the tyrannies of the past century. He had been a teenager in Lithuania when Stalin's Soviet army came in And then the next year, the Nazis came, and he ended up being put in a series of Nazi slave labor camps. Not death camps, because he wasn't Jewish, but slave labor camps. So, you know, as you see the world moving toward a more strongman type of political systems, you know, Jonas has this perspective on it that's incredibly valuable.
What's the takeaway that you have for our listeners, or even just people in general, who are kind of approaching the stage of their life where they're thinking about getting old and the realities of that, and what this project showed you about how they could approach it?
Embrace that period of time as a period of change when you're going to be making decisions about your life, how you want to live, how you want to view the things in your life, just like any other period of time. It's not like you live your life, you live the good part of your life, and then there's this other thing tacked on at the end that kind of sucks and you need to wait it out and then you die. You know, don't think of life that way, because I think that's the way a lot of us think about that old age is just this, you know, something different from the days we have. You pass from 19 to 20 the same way you pass from 79 to 80. It's just a little bit of slight transition. Things are a little different. You have a little more perspective. Maybe you have a little more wisdom. You make better decisions. And to think about it this way, if you compare yourself to 15 years ago, 20 years ago, aren't you wiser now? Don't you make better decisions now? Aren't you less stupid about love and sex now, I hope, than you were 20 years ago? And probably more content with your life. So remember how miserable you were on the most miserable day 20 years ago. So now to project yourself 20 years from now and think, well, maybe this is going to still be going on. Maybe I'm going to be still wiser and still, you know, I have greater perspective. I'm going to be better read. I'm going to be more widely traveled. There will be some things, and there'll be losses along the way, but there's always losses along the way. And I'll deal with them the way I've dealt with them, you know, with the adjusting to the world as it comes at me, with the body that I have and the resources that I have. And that's worked up until now, and I just have faith that it'll work in the future.
You've mentioned loss a few times as we've been talking, and I kind of wanted to end with that. It's something we all face. What did the group you followed teach you about loss?
To understand, to think about loss in a different way. The way I'd thought about loss before this is, like, about my own personal loss. Why am I punished with this? How come I have to go through this? It's such a terrible thing that I go through this, and I go through this loss individually. I started to think about loss differently as just part of what it means to be human, something that I share with every other person who has ever existed. So I'm not singled out for this loss, but I'm in solidarity with all these other people as I'm experiencing the loss. It doesn't make it easy. Loss is hard. But if we think, we're supposed to experience loss, we're supposed to experience the pain of that loss, that's just part of what it means to be human. It doesn't make it less painful, but it means that the pain doesn't quite stick around as long, and it doesn't overshadow everything else in our lives.
You started this project in 2015, and the book came out last year. How many of these six people are still with us now?
There's four of the six that are still alive. Frederick Jones died in April of 2016, and John Sorensen died 2 months later. And John was a gay man who really missed his partner of 60 years, who had died a few years earlier. And John said every time we got together that he wanted to die. And then when he was finally dying, he kind of went through the most agonizing part of it with this joy. He loved music, and he was just allowed himself to be absolutely transported by music that he loved. And he liked to talk to people. So he got the most out of every conversation he had with anybody at the end. And I will never forget this. I was with him on one of his last days, and the physical therapist comes by and says, at the end of the session, he says, I'll be back again tomorrow. And John's in pain from his physical therapy, and he's worn out, and he's at the end of his life, and he says, I look forward to it already. Huh. And I don't live like that, and I have no excuse not to. And now that's how I'm trying to live. How do we live like that without having the good fortune of being on our deathbeds?
Thanks, John.
Jordan, thank you so much. This has been great.
John Leland, New York Times reporter and author. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. You can hit us up on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. We want to hear what you think of this episode or any episode. And of course, you can find them all at TheBigStoryPodcast.ca. And you can find our whole selection of podcasts, including a brand new one coming Monday called Three Trips Ahead, at FrequencyPodcastNetwork.com. And as always, wherever you find us, whatever the show is, we'd love it if you rated us, if you reviewed us, if you told us what you think. Claire Broussard is our lead producer. Ryan Clark is our associate producer. And Megan Coley is our associate editor. She's also the one you're talking to on our social media accounts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We will talk on Monday.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.